The president of Boa Esporte, a football club in Brazil's second division, has defended his decision to offer a contract to a goalkeeper who has just got out of prison. Bruno de Souza was jailed for ordering the murder of a former lover after she gave birth to his child. Her body was cut up and fed to dogs.
In a surprise move, however, the goalkeeper from Flamengo was released last month on a technicality while his attorneys prepare an appeal. Not surprisingly, he wants to play football. What is surprising is that a team has signed him on. The Series B football club Boa Esporte has signed him up for 2 years. They tweeted out that he could soon be back on the pitch.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, former New York City prosecutor, retired FBI profiler, and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Laura Richards, author, advocate, analyst, and founder and director of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for Criminal Minds and Criminal Minds Beyond Borders. And I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. And with us today is also a very special guest.
I'm Paul Francis Sullivan. I am the host of the Sully Baseball Podcast and have been a baseball expert, has been seen on HBO Sports and ESPN2 and featured in several documentaries and in the feature film Spaceman that came out last year. And so I'm a bit of a baseball expert.
And he's the husband of Lisa Zambetti, our very own Lisa Zambetti.
So why in the heck is Paul here with us today? Well,
because he's also the producer of Real Crime Profile, but we started a conversation some time ago about figures in sport, and certainly when violence and abuse or things happen and people are given passes because of who they are or what they symbolise, whether they're popular. And of course, you know, we had spoken about the Reeva Steenkamp case in Real Crime Profile, and Oscar Pistorius, and Nicole and Ron, Nicole Simpson and OJ Simpson. And recently, when I was in London, I was outraged enough seeing and reading, I think as many of us did over the last couple of days, what's happened with a particular case in Brazil. And that particular case, the victim is somebody called, or was called, Elisa Samudio. And in fact, you probably wouldn't see her name in many of the reports because it was much more about the goalkeeper ex-husband that she had who ended up, and I say ended up, he killed her in cold blood and actually did confess to it. And it was meticulously calculated, but he only served a third of his prison sentence, came out and is now back as a goalkeeper in Brazil. And I was really outraged to see the coverage. So I sent an email, I think it was entitled Outrage from London.
Yes, it was.
To the team, including Paul, and basically said, you know, we really need to discuss this. And at the same time, Lisa had said that somebody had also written to us.
Yes, I got a shout out to our listener, Claire, who posted this article. I think it was a different article than you had, Laura, but the article that she sent me was from The Guardian. And I just could not believe my fucking eyes when I read this, and I want to read it to you too, if that's okay.
Was this a what the fuck moment,
I'm sorry,
Lisa?
It's a what the fucking fuck me moment. Excuse me. All right, so you mind if can I read this? Okay. Outrage after Brazil football team signs goalkeeper convicted of killing girlfriend. So the violence and misogyny of Brazilian society was highlighted on Monday when a second division club signed up a goalkeeper who was convicted of murdering his girlfriend and having her body fed to his dogs. Amid smiles and handshakes, Boa Esporte unveiled a 2-year contract for Bruno Fernandes de Souza, who was released from jail last month pending an appeal. The announcement drew anger from the family of the victim, Elisa Samudio, and groups campaigning against the high levels of gender-based violence in Brazil. Women are outraged, and so are the general public. It is as if he'd gone unpunished, wrote Jamila Ribeiro, a political philosopher and feminist activist. Three sponsors withdrew their report from the team in protest against the decision. Well, that's a good thing to know. Hackers posted denunciations on the homepage of the team, but many football fans applauded the return of one of the country's most popular players, despite the gruesome crimes he committed.
And
I mean,
the gruesome crimes he committed. Let's talk a little bit about that, because he was being sued by his ex-girlfriend, Elisa Samudio, for child support. And then she disappeared. Well, he abducted her and tortured her for 6 days. Horrific things. And then chopped her up and had her fed to his dogs. He admitted to this. What kind of person is this, Laura?
Well, one that is absolutely calculated and was meticulous in the execution of this act, and luring her because she dares to challenge him, gets pregnant by him and wants child support money for the child. And he lures her to get into the car saying that he was going to buy her a house. And then for 6 days, a number of people torture her in front of the little boy, which it just is so barbaric. In fact, one of the people apparently was a former police officer. So there were a number of them. And he confesses when he's being interviewed by the police and actually says that, yes, he does chop her up and they feed the body parts to his Rottweilers. But he goes to prison. The judge was pretty clear, saying that, you know, this was meticulous, this was calculated, and sentences him to 22 years.
Yeah, how much of that time does he serve?
Well, he apparently serves, I mean, it's only a third of the sentence.
Like
he comes out
years.
On a technicality and walks straight into this position. And, you know, the team that he's with is sponsored, well, has lots of sponsors, but also the Brazilian government puts money in to the team as well. So it's outrageous on a number of levels. And he's given this platform, which a lot of people are now lobbying and campaigning about, because it's the message that it sends, isn't it, to society and the world. You know, and we had Russia decriminalising domestic violence whilst we in England and Wales had criminalised it. And then you've got Brazil, where actually this particular football team had done a brilliant campaign around rape, where all the players were wearing certain T-shirts and standing up, you know, saying one in three women are raped in their lifetime. So they do all this brilliant stuff standing up, and then they bring this goalkeeper back.
Yeah, I mean, it just makes no sense. I just want to read you what their statement is, the Boa Esporte, a team. They responded with a declaration from the club's president that Bruno had been punished and the club was helping in his readjustment to civil society by offering him the dignity of work. It made no mention of the victim or the crime. You know what kind of work this guy should have? Shoveling shit somewhere. I mean, that's the kind of work he should have. It's just ridiculous.
So that brings us to why Paul is on the other side of the microphone today, because Paul has a tremendous amount of experience and knowledge about sports, and he has something to say about this, don't you, Paul?
I do, and I think that this is an extraordinarily extreme example of illustrating horrible misogyny that goes on in sports, the way that people turn their backs to violence and violence against women specifically in sports, and justifying it with, well, he's really good as a goal. He's a horrible person, but he can really play the position well, and we need a goalkeeper. But it does reflect things. You know, we could sort of step back and say, oh, that's Brazil. That's, you know, this is an extreme example. This is a big epidemic in Brazil. But there are things that happen in America. There's things that happen all around the world. I talk about baseball on my podcast, and there's people turn their backs and turn away from the seriousness of domestic violence with saying, well,
he's a good enough pitcher.
He can throw the ball 100 miles an hour. We need that.
Yeah, the value of his athletics, it surpasses the value of somebody's life.
Right. If he was not a good goaltender, he would be still, he would fill out the length of his sentence, tickets.
And it's the kind of the role model side as well of, you know, of what that says. And I think, interestingly, he does make a statement about it. I wonder what you hear in this, Jim. He said he told a Brazilian TV interviewer, I want to make it clear that even if I stayed here and was given life imprisonment, for example, in Brazil, it would not bring the victim back. I paid dearly. It wasn't easy. This will help me as an experience. It's been a learning experience, not a punishment.
It's all about
word,
him.
Every word fills
me, myself,
with
and
rage.
I.
It's a learning experience.
Yeah. Well,
an incredible way to describe 6 days of torturing your girlfriend and killing her, confessing to it, going to prison, and this is all a good learning experience.
And making your son watch that. Yeah, wonderful thing. And how did that affect his son, and how is his release and his being brought back into sports and stardom, how is that helping his son and hurting his son? But the fact is that it shows the self-centered nature of this person, the fact that that's why he did what he did in the first place. He did it because he didn't want to pay money to his girlfriend for the care of his own son, and so he tortures and kills her. What kind of horrific thing was that on her part to try to get money to support his child? In his mind, she was in attack mode, and so he was justified in doing it.
Challenging his authority and what he says. And well, that's an interesting thing when we think about the culture, a patriarchal society, where his word goes, in that he can actually muster a number of people, including a former police officer, to take part in this. And I think, you know, there's something about here, Paul, and maybe you can say something about the psychology of this, just related to the sports world, is, you know, I find it incredible. And, I'm trying to get my head around why the team and the sponsors would want to have their images and their names, etc., linked to femicide. Why would they do that?
Well, I mean, I think there's a couple things going on here. First of all, it shows how hollow that gesture was when they said they had a day where they were wearing like a special uniform of against,
like a t-shirt, yeah, against rape and raising awareness about how many women are raped, and you know,
exactly. And that's a wonderful gesture, and you saw how hollow it is, because the first chance they could have done something where they said, all right, let's show that we are willing to take a stance beyond putting a shirt on where they could sell in the souvenir stands later. The real action is, oh yeah, he committed some violence to women, but you know, it's more important that we win. But that element of it's more important that we win is something that is really ingrained in the minds of athleticism throughout the world. I mean, I mainly know it throughout America. But you think about how they're presented with this. They're presented with this person who did this unspeakable. If you put that in a movie, it would seem exaggerated.
Well, it sounds like something out of Reservoir Dogs,
exactly.
Quite
right.
Frankly.
Right.
Yeah.
But at the same time, this is about competition. We have to win. We have to win at all costs. Nothing, winning solves all problems. Winning heals all wounds in terms of fan bases, in terms of that's why you sit in the stadium. That's why you buy the foam where number one fingers and everything is. You want to see your team win. And if this player can help you, there's enough people. You read in the article, there's enough people who said, yes, literally, but we need a goaltender and we wouldn't have this chance. There have been plenty of instances in America of players who were accused of rape, players accused of sexual assault, players who are guilty of sexual assault.
And domestic violence.
And domestic violence, who are allowed to continue to play. Or get a slight slap on the wrist for like a game or two, and they get right back into it. Because it's more important for, I'll say, one of the colleges where this happened, Florida State University, to win a bunch of games than it is to discipline anyone.
So the sporting interest becomes a thing of focus versus, you know, in this case, a woman's life is forgotten.
Right.
And,
oh,
you know, it took me a while. And it was actually the Guardian article, Lisa, that I did send you. I just checked, you know, and just trying to find the victim's name of who she was and the history of her.
It wasn't, you know, in there?
Well, it took a little bit to get into the article and then just Googling it. But it's really just, again, how that can be erased and people, you know, totally forgotten, and the weight that's attributed his career, right, versus, you know, her and her life. And I still find there's a context thing here that you can say, well, and a time. So with O.J. Simpson and with Nicole and Ron, you can say, well, that was, you know, 20 years ago. But this is here, present day now, and that's why I'm so outraged about it. The other cases, you can say, well, you know, we've got some way to come. We've got a lot of work to do. But this being the here and now of somehow feeling that he comes straight back into his goalkeeper position, you know, in this club, the statements that are made of him saying, well, I'll treat this as a learning experience. Right. And the media are, allowing
narcissistic.
This.
Narcissistic. Just to give him that kind of a platform to be able to say, oh, yeah, jail was hard for me. Well, you served one third of your term. You were supposed to be there for at least another 15 years. Why not? Why weren't you there for that time? Why wasn't her life worth more than that?
And, you know, and it's like you say, Laura, eventually, you know, her name is going to be erased and the whole thing is going to be erased. I mean, Paul has a story about that, and it almost gets mythologized in a different way where he's going to look like the victim. And right. And Paul has a story about
and
that.
And that's what he's trying to transfer. Right. That's exactly it, the poor me thing. But just to put the caveat on it, that four backers have dropped the club. So that's a positive thing,
right? Yeah,
including their biggest sponsor. But of course, we need to bring more pressure to bear because it's really only when the sponsors or the advertisers or where the money trail, when you hit the money trail, that they start to listen to what's being said. And so lobbying and campaigning, you can get the right result, but you have to push really hard. And it's when the backers, the sponsors drop out.
Well,
go ahead,
Paul. As I said before, one of the things I think brought him to this team was probably the attention and the money they could make from it, the tickets they could sell, the T-shirts they can sell, and the fact that I know very little about Brazilian soccer, and yet we're talking about this team right now. So it's like the first time that they think, well, maybe we can get some money. In baseball, I know there are major leagues and minor leagues. Like the major leagues, your teams like the Dodgers, the Yankees, the Red Sox, or the major leagues. The minor leagues have to do everything to scrape together attention, and they'll sometimes do wild publicity stunts just to get, you know, people
on the
to
radar.
Show, yeah, to get on the radar. But they tend to be more, you know, more whimsical. They would be like, you know, cow milking contests, or they'll sign Billy Crystal to play one day. You know, it's sort of like something innocuous like that that gets some fun press, as opposed to hiring a monster to play.
Right.
But if you then affect their bottom line by having their sponsors pull out, that kind of cancels out why you would bring him on board.
Right. I mean, it's the old adage of, you know, no publicity. There's no such thing as bad publicity. But actually, there is, you know, in this situation.
But they could spin it this way. So we learned our lesson. We were going to sign it. But then we realized how bad it was. And we're so sensitive. And you know that because we sold the jerseys last year. So now, because of that, we're not going to sign him. There was a player. It was a baseball player named Jose Reyes, who was a player for the Colorado Rockies, who assaulted his wife in Hawaii around Christmas time 2015. And even though there were no charges, the charges weren't filed, baseball instituted a new domestic violence policy, basically in response to the horrible domestic policy that the National Football League has in America. They want to seem more...
to be seen to be doing something to tackle it.
Right, exactly, so to speak. And
quite bloody right, too. I mean,
absolutely.
You know, we're in 2016, or what year are we here?
2017.
In your case.
Oh, in this one, he was suspended.
I'm not that jet lagged.
he was suspended in 2016. And
what was the new policy?
The new policy was you were allowed to be suspended even if you weren't convicted, even if the charges weren't filed, because they knew that one of the reasons why charges weren't filed was because most of the times they're not filed. Most of the times there's fears, what we talk about on this podcast all the time. And so baseball suspended him for, you know, the 30 games for the first offense, and Colorado cut him, said goodbye, you're not on our team anymore. Now, it was a lot easier for them to do that because they had a younger, less expensive shortstop to play his position who was having a wonderful season. But they did the right thing. Of course,
In that context, yes.
It's like, geez, can we afford it? But of course, he was gobbled up immediately by the New York Mets, his former team. And he arrived in New York and standing ovation in New York. People selling the jerseys because he had been with the team when they made the playoffs before and they needed a shortstop. And I knew several Met fans who said, I hate what he did too, but our shortstop situation's a mess. And the biggest pushback that he got was he didn't play well. If he started hitting home runs left and right and started making the spectacular plays like he did when he played for the Mets 4 or 5 years ago, it would be considered a Cinderella story.
Right. Well, it starts in college. I think it probably starts in high school, where people who excel in sports are given privileges, they are looked up to, and they start to feel emboldened, just like
and
criminals
entitled.
Do. They're entitled, yes. And so they will take what they want, they'll do what they want, and they'll get away with things. They'll avoid discipline. And how many cases have we heard of where people have alleged that college athletes, particularly football players, for some reason, they have a very short and wild season. How many games do they play in a college football season?
What, 10 at the most.
Right. So the rest of the year and in between games, they are training and they are being sort of big men on campus. And
big and violent men. I mean, you're bringing in people who are big, it's violent in terms of the sport itself. I mean,
it's a contact sport.
Right. Yeah. I played football in high school and I did not play in college because I got hurt. you get hurt smashing into each other. And the bigger and more aggressive you are, the better a football player you're going to be. And if you've been coddled since I went to high school with a couple of people, one person in particular who actually did make it to the NFL. But I could see even he was being protected. He was being coddled. And he was getting college offers from some colleges that he wasn't quite up to snuff academically for, but they will fall over themselves because he was, I'm not going to mention his name, but he was super talented and eventually played a couple of years pro. And if you imagine that this is going on where you have people saying, do what you want, we'll lavish you, we want you to come here, to our college, and you'll be worshipped by a community. And a lot of times these communities don't have a pro team when you have the big colleges teams. So that the teams in the South, the teams in Notre Dame, the teams at Penn State, there's no like NFL team around there. So they're worshipped by the entire community.
Yeah, when I was stationed in Little Rock for a while, I think their stadium it's like 78,000 people that show up for college football games. Yeah. So it's a very big event in those towns, and the players are obviously put on pedestals and they're worshipped as gods. And if they do something wrong, it's weighed against their value to the team as opposed to the damage they did to a victim or society in general. And I think many times young women in colleges are told, do you really want to go up against this guy? He's a football star. He's a baseball star. He's a track star, whatever. Why would you want to go and ruin that person's career? Why would you want to ruin their life? Well, wait a minute. The criminal is the one that ruined their own life. And this guy, this clown in Brazil, who's a goaltender, who says, well, this was my learning lesson, and it was tough me going to jail. It's complete and utter horseshit.
But he said, in the future, I'll be able to laugh at this, was his other comment.
Oh.
I mean, it's also, just to say that we're talking about the sporting
dangerous
context in particular here, but this could be any corporation or law enforcement agency or in parliament, because I've seen it in lots of different places. Well, don't ruin his career. Think very carefully about this and what that means if you do report, and actually people are pressured not to do anything,
right.
If they are a live victim. But just, that entitlement part that you talked about, Jim and Paul, in terms of, they are the real stars on campus and they're given a free pass to do anything, that they become untouchable.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you're dealing with, isn't it? Untouchable, because then it's condoned. Everyone feels, these sponsors in particular or people who are signing him, that somehow, let's just give him a complete pass and forget about the history and give him another chance. I'd still find in present day 2017, how is that even possible?
I'll tell you one way it's absolutely possible. And I'm not condoning, I'm just saying how the mindset could get to that point. When you take like the University of Tennessee, I mean, there's no specific one I'm pointing to Tennessee, but I know that's like 100,000 seat football stadium they have there. And like the Florida State, which is in Tallahassee, they have a gigantic football stadium there. But beyond just the butts in the seats there, the college football gets so much television money. This is millions and millions of dollars, and the exposure that a few Florida State's not on the big game, it's going to be Auburn, it's going to be University of South Carolina, it's going to be Nebraska, whatever it is. You get that money partly based upon the exposure you're getting nationally. And that's millions of dollars coming, and a lot of it's going into the university, into the university presidents. And so it is important to keep your profile. If you have a crap college football team, they're not going to put you on the big game. You're not going to get the bowl game. You're not going to get on ESPN. And so there's so much money in amateur athletics in college that if your huge star is going to be suspended, I say suspended, like the worst thing you could do is be taken off of the game. You should be in jail, but suspended, that not only reflects upon your, you know, it reflects on the college, it reflects on the program, it reflects on your bottom line and the millions of dollars that could be coming in.
Yeah, and when you say millions, that's millions a game sometimes. And it's hundreds of millions over the course of a year, hundreds and hundreds of millions over the course of a athlete's collegiate career and coaches' careers. And that really does affect the bottom line. So I understand when people say, you know, well, you know, this is, it's better for them to, you know, actually give them a pass and so forth. That's understandable. It's actually 100% wrong too, because all you're doing is reinforcing this behavior. And what's going to happen in the end is something like happened here in this Brazilian soccer team,
right,
where the guy felt so entitled, so, you know, impenetrable that he could do whatever he wanted. And he actually, in the end, I mean,
he
basically got away with murder.
Well, he did. But I mean, in terms of he, you know, he confessed under when he was being interrogated because he was originally protesting his innocence. But currently, he's due for a medical at the club on Tuesday. So, and there'll be a press conferencing following it. So it'll be interesting just to see in this particular case whether the pressure of the world stage, you know, of many lobbying and campaigning, there's been lots of demonstrations. There's one in London as well as in Brazil, to see whether that pressure changes anything in terms of what the club do in terms of signing him. But I think, you know, we go back to sort of guilty until proven rich, you know, in many senses. And that's the part that we've come a long way in some ways when thinking about violence against women and girls. And then in another, when something like this happens, it's a clear and stark reminder that we still have so much more to do. And, you know, so much of it is connected to money and power. And of course, many of these crimes, they're power and control crimes too.
Seven months ago, this video surfaced of Rice dragging Palmer out of the elevator. In July, the NFL suspended him for just 2 games. Now the NFL and the Baltimore Ravens are coming under fire for not handing down a tougher punishment in the beginning. NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell acknowledging in a statement saying in part, "I didn't get it right. Simply put, we have to do better."
You're talking about, Laura, you were talking about the what the public pressure and what pressure of public opinion could actually turn some of these towards good. And I think the biggest example for that in America was the Ray Rice situation. Now, Ray Rice was a famous, very popular football player.
I remember it. I remember how all of this transpired. And yeah, please go ahead.
And I won't go into all the details of it, but he was accused of aggravated assault on his, at the time, his fiancee, and he was suspended 2 games for that. Now, keep in mind, there's an incredibly famous suspension that took place in football involving the biggest star, Tom Brady, who supposedly deflated a couple of footballs before a big football game. He was suspended 4 games.
So hang on, deflating, just indulge me a little bit, deflating balls, that this is seen as
some kind of advantage. It would mean it would be easier to hold on to and catch because it's a little deflated.
It's a little deflated.
Right, okay.
Deflating the football is worth four games, and even though he's won two Super Bowls since then, it's been haunting him. People are like, you deflated those footballs, you deflated those footballs. Ray Rice's assaulting of his fiancée, two games.
Right, but just to talk about that, what Ray Rice did, we've all basically seen that because there was an actual security video
in the
elevator where he brutally beat her, knocks her completely unconscious, and basically drags her.
Which found its way into the public domain.
Mm-hmm. After the suspension was laid down. It was after the NFL suspended him for two games, TMZ got a hold of this videotape, of which the NFL said, we had no idea about this tape. We had no idea where we could have gotten that. And TMZ said, we called them, they gave it to us in 30 minutes, and we don't have a team of lawyers working with us. Mm-hmm. And so basically, they called the NFL's BS on that. And suddenly, the Ray Rice suspension became
big
for
news.
The entire season, and people were saying, wait a minute. And it went from being, well, something happened at home, to, no, this is what he's doing, dragging this woman into the elevator. Let's all see it with our own eyes. Now, Ray Rice hasn't played football since, and Baltimore cut him. He was their most popular player, or one of their most popular players, and Baltimore cut him, and he hasn't played since. But I think that's an example of the public opinion. We saw what it was.
The backlash that they tried to brush it under the rug. They were going to let it be two-game suspension.
A bit of a storm that goes away.
But because there was so much backlash after that was publicly released, that video, and we saw how brutal it was,
right.
That's why, actually, he was suspended, and then he hasn't been able to play since then.
But most women aren't lucky enough to have
a video.
Well, funnily enough, there has just been a video released in London whilst talking about this. It actually wasn't a London case, but it was at the same time that this came out in the article that I read in the Guardian, actually, about Elisa's case and what happened. And it's a female who, I mentioned it to you, Jim, who was assaulted. It was actually a very serious assault on a stairway by her partner.
Mm.
And it's gone viral.
Oh, it's horrible.
It's so difficult to watch, but she wanted it released because she wanted to show people, you know, what domestic violence looks like, the brutality of her offense.
It's not just raising your voice or pushing around.
Or they just push me down the stairs, or, you know, when something is dressed up, or this euphemism that they had a troubled relationship, or it was a volatile relationship. Well, let's see what it looks like. And the true face of it is terrifying and shocking. And this particular footage, I mean, he knocks her down the stairs a number of times, but she ended up hospitalized. She fought for her life. You know, her face was badly damaged, as well as ribs, and actually just being a, some people just couldn't watch the thing, you know, the footage all the way through. But we have to put it on a public stage,
right,
so that people can really understand what we're talking about when it's dressed up as something else. And it is completely unacceptable, you know, in sport, in our workplaces, in every walk of life. It's completely unacceptable, and people do need to stand up and challenge it. That's the power of the voices, you know, voices of victims, but also, you know, for campaigners. It's a very important thing that I do in terms of campaigning and giving people a platform and making sure people understand the realities of violence and domestic violence and really all its faces, because it is absolutely unacceptable. In 2017, we're in this position where this entitled man is being given this position, this platform, and is the person that young children will be looking up to and setting the kind of the tone for what does a good man and a good role model look like.
Yeah, that's what scares me, is even just psychologically, you know, in the background, what it does to how people treat women and what the threshold is for what is okay. And I think it is so damaging.
It really is.
But there's still, athletes are always going to be role models. I was always angry when Charles Barkley did that ad saying, I'm not your role model, your teacher's role model. I said, no, Charles, you're a role model. Whether you like it or not, when you sign the contract, kids wear your uniforms. People look up to you. So what you do and how you act, and there are great sports role models out there. There are great people you should emulate. But then again, it's always dangerous to say that. Because one of the good guys was OJ. One of the good guys was Kirby Puckett, the famous player for the Twins who beat his wife, we found out later on. So it's always based on the public perception. Ray Rice was considered to be one of the good guys. So, you know, Bobby Cox, who was a manager of the Atlanta Braves, one of the great baseball managers of all time, in the Hall of Fame, ceremonies for him, revere him. He had a domestic violence dispute, which the wife called the police because he was beating her. And a week later, they do a press conference with him and his wife sitting next to each other. So, like, it was just an argument that got out of hand. We just were yelling. I don't know why I called. And it was because that would have been too damaging. And so this is just, we put these people up on a pedestal because that's what we want from them. But we put the emphasis on them hitting the three home runs. And there's a certain, we create a mythology about the players. That's what we're more interested in. The story that I brought in, and this is the minute you sent the angry from London email, I thought of this because this is a story, and if anyone who follows my podcast knows I've brought this up before. Donnie Moore was a pitcher when I was in high school. He pitched for the California Angels, and he shot his wife in front of his kids and then turned the gun on himself and committed suicide. And he was a former player who very famously, at least for baseball fans, I have to remember not everyone is as big a baseball fan as me, but he led up one of the most famous home runs in baseball history. He was part of the Angels, and the Angels were one pitch away from getting to the World Series. He threw a pitch, and the player on the Red Sox hit a home run to give him the lead, and they went on to win and go to the World Series. And that became his legacy. They kept playing that clip over and over again because it was such an exciting moment.
That he blew the game.
That this guy hit a home run when they were down to their last pitch and the entire place was going crazy. And he hit it into the stands to give for the lead. And this guy was the GOAT. And you even saw the shot of him with his head down and like, oh, so disappointed in losing the game and everything. And that, people would bring that up over the years and show the clip. And then when he wound up shooting his wife, and his wife wound up living, and then turning the gun on himself in front of his kids, the way that it was covered, and in this article that I pulled up that was from July 1989 when it happened, is all about how he was haunted by that pitch. It was all about how he was so sad that he couldn't win that game for the Angels. I mean, the first sentence of this article is, tormented by the memory of one pitch and despondent over his failing career and marital troubles.
There's that euphemism again, marital troubles.
There you go.
Former California Angels pitcher Donnie Moore shot his wife numerous times before killing himself. All indications are that Donnie Moore and his wife Tanya became involved in an argument. And during the argument, Moore produced a handgun and shot his estranged wife and turned the gun on himself. And this took place in front of his kids. And they bring up that a little bit, but then within the last five paragraphs of this are about the home run he let up in the 1986 playoffs, of which the last couple of quotes are from his teammate. And this is, this really struck me because he started blaming not Donnie Moore for shooting his wife and shooting himself, but the sports writers, of which he said, everything revolved around one pitch. You reporters destroyed a man's life over one pitch. The guy was not the same after that. I never saw the guy be credited with getting us to the playoffs because all you heard about was just that one pitch. Ever since that, he was extremely depressed. And so the story is that we found out later that he was imprisoning his wife. He was beating his wife. He was threatening his wife. If she ever talked to anyone, she was trapped in this home in Orange County.
This is the marital troubles.
This is marital troubles.
No, it's coercive control.
And the mythology, to this day, if I bring up Donnie Moore, it's like, oh man, he was someone who cared so much about his team that he couldn't live with himself. And less than 3 years after letting up the home run, he turned the gun on himself. And I even believe it. I was in high school when this happened. I was like, oh man, maybe we were all too hard. Poor guy.
So who's the victim? Who becomes the victim
and
the transfer?
Like, oh, I, you know, and there were people even coming up to me because I'm a Boston fan and Boston won that game. That was the great, that was one of the greatest moments of my childhood. And people say, I bet you feel guilty now. I bet someone said that to me. I bet you feel guilty now that Henderson hit that home run off of Moore because Moore was so tormented he wound up killing himself, as if it's the fans' fault for booing him.
Right.
But yet he had a history of violence against his wife, and this was the culmination of it. And who knows how much she was trying to support him and you know, the fact that they have kids together and how he just...
And deal with his demons and try and manage
him. She probably was, because that's typically what happens, right? In those kinds of relationships that where, because they truly love the father of their child, they truly want that
relationship to work. Want the relationship to work.
So despite that, the fact that, you know, she probably did help him a lot. Remember, this was an estranged wife. I mean, did he...
Well, it was on separation, actually. When I read the article that Paul just referred to, it does talk about separation. And we know that she had tried to separate from him, and separation is a high risk factor to serious harm and homicide.
But he brought a gun to this meeting with his wife, right?
He said, he had separated with his wife of 16 years about a month ago.
Yeah. So the other statistic which I'll give you is that we have a project in the UK, and I know it will reflect here, called Counting Dead Women. And, you know, out of 900 women who were killed, and this isn't an official law enforcement stat, this is a feminist who's been collecting the data, called Karen Ingala Smith. So out of 900 women who were killed at the hands of men, 76% of them who were killed by their ex-partner were killed on separation, with 34% of them killed within the first month. So the first 3 months really are the heightened time around risk. So I always look for the small print on these articles that a lot of people miss. But the media, you know, we have to challenge them in the way that they report and the way that they change the narrative, and the story becomes something very different. What drove this man to kill? Well, nothing drove this person to kill. You know, it was about a choice. And so the narrative gets changed, sometimes subtly and other times spectacularly, which in this case, you know, the narrative and the urban myth gets perpetuated that this poor guy, you know, he had such a tough time, you know, in terms of his sport, and he, you know, it must have been so awful for him. And then he was vilified and he ended up taking his own life. And so she is written out of the story effectively, along with the children, and it becomes a totally different story.
And also it plays to a part of what fans want to think. They want to think that, you know, because I'm a diehard baseball fan, and I want to, and I care so much what happens to my team, and I get super high when they win, I get super low when they lose, and you want to think that the players care that much as well. And so this plays to that. This plays to, oh, he wanted to win so badly, and he was so taken, he cares as much. People are more willing to accept the fact that he was willing to commit suicide as kind of an honorable Harry Carey death,
right,
for the California Angels.
Just utter BS. It just makes me so angry. This is Laura from London angry now.
Yeah, there you go. But when you think about it, what you just said about the risk, they had only separated a month earlier.
Right.
She put up with this for 16 years. She was probably trying to help him that whole time. And the fact that this, 1 month later, after she finally got away from him, that she ends up dead. I mean, she just becomes another one of those statistics.
Right, and that contextual, you know, fact, and it probably was within this situation, just knowing how they tend to play out. You know, if I can't have you, no one can. This kind of ownership and entitlement, the sense of, you know, losing his career, losing, you know, his standing, losing his status, and now his partner leaving. You know, these are all, in his mind, catastrophic things that are happening, and the loss of control. So this is him taking control. But of course, none of that is written into this story of actually what happened. It's completely changed and turned on its head.
The fact that his 7- and 10-year-old sons were there is buried in the story a lot deeper than the fact he let up a home run to Dave Henderson in the playoffs.
Commissioner Rob Manfred made a strong statement Tuesday, issuing a 30-game suspension for Araldis Chapman for domestic violence allegations stemming from an October incident at his Miami home. The Yankees reliever is not going to appeal the decision. Said Manfred, "After reviewing the staff report, I found Mr. Chapman's acknowledged conduct on that day to be inappropriate under the negotiated policy, particularly his use of a firearm and the impact of that behavior on his partner."
Posting, we've been answering listener questions at the beginning of a podcast, but I had some that just occurred to me to ask you guys now that it's kind of appropriate for what we're talking about. So this is from Jay. "Hey guys, I wanted to thank you for educating us on crime and domestic violence. A few months ago, a lady friend sent me a text saying her boyfriend hit her and she was afraid. Not sure why she reached out to me, but luckily I'd been listening to your podcast. I tried to get her to call the police, but she refused. So I sent her a link to the Dash and I asked her to read it and then tell me what she thinks. She admitted that she needed more help. So I sent her the number for a domestic abuse hotline, and with her help, we got her to call the police and press charges. So now my friend's safe, and I'm not sure she would have gotten out of it if not for the podcast. I'm also friends with the abuser. I'm happy to say he's changed his behavior quite a lot since getting arrested. After being in the middle and hearing both sides of the story, it seemed like a very toxic relationship both ways. He's completely stopped drinking and seems to be doing a better path. So my question is, do you have any information to help abusers change? I looked online and only found some pretty basic stuff. You know, with the victim, it was easy for me to know what to do. But with him, I had to kind of guess what would help. And it's not easy to see a person's dark side and to get them to confront it, especially when it's something that disgusts you so much. I think this type of information would be helpful for other people." And I have to say that we've received this question a couple of times, you know, what to do when somebody realizes within themselves that they have this dark side and they have some of these tendencies to be controlling and manipulative. And what should they do?
Well, I mean, it's a great question, and I don't know whether that came in from someone in from America or the UK. Did it say anything about context as well, just so I can talk to both?
One of the questions come, I don't really want to disclose too much because they've asked me not to.
Right.
But it looks like one is not, English is not his first language, so I'm not sure if that says where he is or not. So.
Just because in, you know, in different countries, and obviously as we're seeing in Brazil, things are seen in very different ways, but you know, and in terms of what resources go into to programs, but certainly if I talk about the UK first of all, we do have a national helpline which is called the Respect Helpline, which men who, predominantly men, not exclusively, but if they feel that they are exhibiting signs or are behaving in a way that is abusive and controlling, they can call and get some advice from Respect. But we do have perpetrator programs as well, accredited perpetrator programs for domestic violence specifically. And actually, a number of the accredited programs have just been evaluated, and it's under Project Mirabelle that looked at the five-year research into the outcomes of men's participation in those accredited programs. You know, and what it shows effectively is that those who want to change have to invest in that change, you know, and that's a big thing. You actually have to want to change your behaviour. And they've shown that the long-term outcome, that those who do go on those programs, any specific people who can, so they're assessed to see whether they can even, you know, they can even go on the programs in the first place, but that some of them do stop using violence and abuse and controlling behaviours against their partners. But of course, it's a longitudinal study, so these things do take time to see. You know, there's been another very effective program that was up in Hull, in which is the north of the UK, called Strength to Change, which was run by someone called Mark Coulter. And he did a lot of work with perpetrators, but more specifically around shame and fear that they hold, and around this concept of the man box, which Tony Coulter, I believe his name over here, he's a big name over here, has done a lot of work talking to young boys and men, which is why it's called the man box. And it's about the gendered way that girls and boys are brought up and how boys and men are expected to behave, i.e. you've got to be strong, you can't show emotion, you can't cry, all these things that get internalised, which means that the way that you can express yourself can...
physically.
be problematic. Mm-hmm. Yes, problematic, abusive, controlling, you know, and a whole spectrum of things. So actually it starts with educating young girls and young boys and engaging men and women about acceptable forms of behaviour, you know, and that's the real challenge for us as a society, which is why I find it appalling that we see what's going on in Brazil with this particular case, because it's the message that it sends to young boys and to men that violence is acceptable and people support it. And if we spend a lot more time and money talking in schools about what healthy relationships look like, age-appropriate healthy relationships, we'll be cutting this stuff off at the pass and getting into true intervention and prevention rather than mopping up the blood at the end of the spectrum and dealing with people who have serious psychological harm done unto them. So it's a long answer, but for me, you have to do lots of different things at one time. You can throw money into change programs, accredited domestic violence perpetrator programs, and some of them, you know, if they're accredited, the relevant people who are appropriate to go on those programs are showing good results. But it's picking up young boys and girls at the very early part. And I was listening to a program in North London. I mean a program in the sense that it's the nub of it is a nail bar that young girls can go into, and it was really designed so that they would talk about their experience of being in gangs and domestic violence and things that they've been exposed to. And what I was hearing from, and I'm actually going to go in and talk to some of the girls there, what I was hearing about was that young girls don't see abuse, whether it's controlling or physically violent, as abuse. They see it as actually it's somebody showing love for them. And it's attention that's being bestowed upon. They see this as a healthy relationship, in inverted commas. That's the challenge that we have. That's the psychological challenge, and that's where we need to have investment of time. And in fact, our government has just agreed to do healthy relationships, you know, and education within schools rather than just teach them the mechanics of having sex. Mm-hmm. So you have to really invest in that. But there is help out there for individuals. There are helplines that they can call. The first step is acknowledging and identifying and owning your behaviour and taking responsibility for it.
Right. And what I thought was amazing about that communication from the listener is that he said, well, I knew what to do with respect to a victim. Well, the only reason why he knows what to do with respect to a victim is because he's listened to the podcast and because of people like Laura who have been trying to get this information out there. Because it's not blasted up from every station, every radio station, every TV station. This is information that, for some reason, people just aren't aware of. The only program that I know that's anything like assisting offenders or potential offenders is Stop It Now. It's made for people who might think that they might harm a child or commit sexual violence. But I think that if you called in because you had issues with violence against women, I think you could probably also utilize those same kind of resources. So Stop It Now would be a good place to look.
I was going to say that to me, and correct me if you think I'm wrong, I would say if somebody is in crisis now and feels out of control now and there's alcohol involved in it, it would seem like going to Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous to address that. And that's a confidential place where you can talk about, you know, how alcoholism or drugs are fueling this kind of behavior. And that might be a first step that people could take. And, you know, because there's nothing called Abusers Anonymous that I know of. So it seems like at least that's one place to start going and get referrals.
Right. Well, thank you, Paul, for bringing your insights about sports and kind of marrying them with our insights that we typically try to focus on the victims and give them a voice. And thank you for helping us give the voices to victims of people who are in the public limelight because of their athletic ability, but who should not be making all this money after they've done such horrific things to women and children.
Well, it's my pleasure being on. I talked about this during the World Series where there was a person who was suspended for domestic abuse on the Cubs, and all these Cub fans are going on, oh, or we haven't won since 1908. We got to win. And I kept saying, how could you be cheering for this guy? And people, anytime I would bring it up, I would get, you know, stick to sports or, you know, it's something that happened in the past. He made a mistake. And I'm like, no, it's not a mistake. And I think we got to stop using sports as an excuse. You know, my love for seeing my team win shouldn't excuse, or it shouldn't be at that cost.
In light of our discussion today, I would like to make a recommendation, and it's going to be a difficult one, actually, but it's a recommendation about an American football hero, actually, a true American hero, and that's Dr. Tom Katina. He was an All-American football player for Brown University, and then he went to medical school and decided to dedicate his career to helping underprivileged areas in Africa. And I believe he started 5 years in Nigeria, and then he went to the Nuba Mountains of Sudan. There's about 1 million people there who live in the Nuba Mountains, between at the lower extremity of Sudan, right at the north of South Sudan. And there's a very brutal dictator there who also started the genocide in Rwanda. He is a war criminal, and yet he runs this country now. And he's brutally attacking the people there. And Dr. Tom Katina is the only doctor for these 1 million people. And they're being brutalized and bombed, and it's just horrific. But in the heart of all this is a man who saw a need and really gave up everything to go there by himself and run this hospital and train local residents to eventually take over the hospital. And Ken Carlson, who's a friend of mine, was the director of a documentary called The Heart of Nuba. And if you look it up online, and we'll post the link to the trailer on our website and we'll tweet it. But the fact is, you can't see the movie because every distributor, every major film and TV distributor and streaming distributor has turned down this film. And it's shocking because everybody who's seen the screening of it was just moved by it to tears and applaud Dr. Tom Katina and Ken Carlson for making the movie. So what we'd like you to do is look at the trailer, and if you're interested in seeing this, then reach out to Netflix and HBO and the different film festivals, because all of the big film festivals have turned them down.
Yeah, I can't imagine that, Jim. Jim just showed us the trailer. It is beautiful. I mean, I started crying during it.
It's moving and it's disturbing and it's shot wonderfully. Mm-hmm. And this message needs to be told. People need to understand what this horrible dictator has been doing and what a wonderful hero. And he's an American hero, mm-hmm. Dr. Tom Katina is. And we would love for you to reach out and ask why these different purveyors of entertainment and even places like Netflix that has a documentary channel, why are they not letting this film be distributed?
Right. So if you have any access to any film festivals that, you know, we could, you know, send it to those administrators, that would be really helpful. Actually, Jim, right. I know somebody at the Santa Fe Film Festival that right. I would love to get them to see it. But, you know, reach out and see if you can support us on this really important documentary.
Yeah. And Ken Carlson's going to come in and we're going to talk to him about the war crimes that are being committed in the mountains of Nuba. And we would love for you to hear the details of his story because it's really unbelievable.
And I'm going to give a recommendation, just going back to what we were discussing, for people to look up the femicide census, which giving a shout out to Karen Ingala Smith, which, you know, she started a process of counting dead women, which is very similar to what I started in 2001 working in the Metropolitan Police when I started to ask questions about domestic violence and ask how many victims are killed every year. And me working within the heart of New Scotland Yard, we couldn't get the exact figures year on year for how many victims were killed in domestic violence situations. And that's when really I started counting predominantly dead women and looking at the link with domestic violence incidents, in inverted commas, i.e. the pattern, and then the homicides. And what, you know, is depressing is that we're still hearing about cases now where those same risk factors were present, high risk factors, and yet people are still, women predominantly, are still being killed. And it goes back to what we've just been discussing, really. You know, there's a number of recommendations from her research, and I did mention the 900 mm-hmm. figure and the 76, which was exactly the same as my report showed in 2003, with that heightened risk time around the first 3 months. Mm-hmm. But one of the things she's calling for is the appropriate reporting of domestic violence cases in the media. And that news reports should not be sympathetic to the perpetrators and privileging the perpetrator's story, and women not being written out of their own reports by giving this one sort of dimensional view, mm-hmm. Predominantly the perpetrator's perspective.
Right, so, just like in the sports cases.
Exactly, and that's the tie-in. So Google it and have a look. I mean, you know, there's no one platform in the UK that does monitor and track cases, and the same if we put it on the European stage, and the same if we put it on the international stage. So, you know, this is where people, you know, don't get a sense really of the global nature of the same problems in different parts of the world. And really, it's just as important what's going on in Brazil as it is in Russia, as it is in the US to the UK. So that's a good shout out, and for services to be funded. So there's a lot of specialist domestic violence services that resources are being cut, and the same with, you know, services like Paladin that are not being funded by the government or the state. We have to raise money, mm-hmm. And that's what I've been doing in London, trying to, you know, look at the fundraising platform for Paladin, these vital services that are lifelines for victims, that they really do need them, those who are at risk of serious harm and murder.
All right, well, thank you for doing that.
I have one recommendation, too, since we're talking about sports. It seems appropriate to mention one of my favorite TV series. It's so close to my heart. It just has meant so much to me. Paul's laughing because he knows what I'm going to say. The Friday Night Lights, the TV series, is just... if anybody told me that I'd love a TV show about West Texas football, boy, I would never have believed it, because it's really just so far away from anything. But this show is about all the things that sports should be. It's about heart. It's about family. It's about perseverance. It's about loyalty. It's about never giving up. And it's just a wonderful story about a coach and his team that he never gives up on. And Coach Taylor and his marriage to Tammy. And I swear, I have based my mothering on Tammy Taylor.
Wow.
So
wow.
I really love this show. It stars Kyle Chandler and Connie Britton, and I just encourage you to watch it, and you will, I promise you, Paul will be my witness that you will be crying after the first episode, and the ending episode of the series will just leave you breathless. So please check out Friday Night Lights, the TV series.
Thank you very much for listening to this very special episode of Real Crime Profile. Till next time.
So if you enjoy our podcast and would like to support us, there are a couple of important things you can do. First, you can go over to iTunes and give us a positive 5-star review. You can check out our sponsors and take advantage of the special promotions for Real Crime Profile listeners. You can go over and like our Facebook page, and you can follow us on Twitter. But most importantly, you can share our podcast with friends, family, and anyone you know would be interested in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. So thank you for listening.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter or counselling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214-946-4357, or go on their website, www.genesisshelter.org, or the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.
If you're a regular listener to the show, you know we have great brands like Blue Apron, Audible, and Casper advertising with us, and they keep coming back because our listeners really respond to them, which we're really thankful for. Well, if you happen to own a business or manage the advertising buy for one, then you should consider advertising on Real Crime Profile. Podcast advertising is on the rise, and it's one of the most effective ways of reaching consumers on the go today. So please go to wondery.com/advertisers. Again, it's wondery.com/advertisers. And get in touch with us. Thanks.